Mr. Gevers.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. We're here this morning, I'm Bob Gevers on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Webb, Tatorian Webb. We're here this morning on one issue, that being whether or not the district court abused its discretion in allowing evidence of a 1996 conviction for dealing in cocaine in at the trial of my client at the district court for possession with intent to distribute cocaine, methamphetamine, and other controlled substances. We recognize, quite frankly, that we're swimming upstream in this instance, but we're asking the court to consider particularly the case laws that's come down from this court in Simpson, recognizing that the 404B evidence is excluded. It's a rule of exclusion and not a rule of admission, and that the courts must take a very long and hard look.
Is, of course, Rule 402, which says relevant evidence comes in and irrelevant evidence stays out. Was there an objection at trial based on relevance?
No, Your Honor. It was under 404.
Well, Your Honor, that may be the problem here, because although I could see a relevance objection in this case, if it's relevant, then it's probably outside the condemnation of Rule 404. So the real question is relevance.
Well, Your Honor, we believe the question was at the time and remains also one of the full probative versus prejudicial value that
it has.
That's
Rule 403. And again, it's not 404. You don't just it's one of the problems. Lawyers on both sides tend to parrot Rule 404 when very often what one has to do is go through the 402 and 403 approach.
Your Honor, and I believe that 403 was mentioned at the trial in this matter as far as the probative and prejudicial weighing that the court must do under the four-prong test as well from 404 that set
forth. That's what I was going to say. The courts haven't made it any easier on you since they have regularly said that part four of the 404B analysis is a 403 analysis.
Yes.
So we owe apologies to the bar to the extent we've muddied the waters.
All four-part tests should be abolished forthwith, but not within the power of this panel, I suppose.
And it's too late for me to ask.
There's a biography of Justice White which says that he told his incoming clerks, create no multi-factor tests and apply none. I wish that view were more widely held.
Well, therefore, under the fourth prong of the test, and therefore 403, we believe that the prejudicial value of allowing this 1996 conviction to come in was far outweighed because it was so prejudicial. The evidence in the case against my client, Mr. Webb, consisted, as far as his intent, consisted really from a cooperating witness, Ms. Kelly Hartman, who testified on behalf of the government that Mr. Webb was fully aware of the drugs in the home, that he spent a good bit of time there, lived there. And although she said, as I recollect, that she did not ever see him selling from that home, that he would leave the home. She herself admitted to selling from the home. So we have her testimony presented to the jury, and then right at the end of the government's case, then we have the conviction that comes in that basically says, well, okay, now that you've heard all that, even though Ms. Hartman can't say that he was possessing with intent to distribute in that home and never saw him do that, because he has this conviction from 1996, you must consider that. Granted, a limiting instruction was provided by the court at the time that the evidence came in and at the time that the jury was instructed. However, there was also evidence from Ms. Hartman that we didn't object to under 404, that he had, in fact, had other dealings in that house, as I just related.
But he was essentially making the innocent bystander argument. You know, here I am, I'm just nearby, and now you're trying to tag all these drugs on me. And rightly or wrongly, there are quite a few cases that have said that falls within the exceptions that Rule 404B recognizes for admission of evidence.
Yes, you're correct. we're asking the court to really ask the district courts to apply that four-prong test, particularly that fourth prong, to say we really need to look at this point, the probative value. One of the arguments we made at the district court was this is almost like a late hit. Why do you need this at this point? And are we ever going to be able to tell whether this is going to be harmless error, if you will, because this evidence has come in and now you're just throwing this on? I don't know how we tell it's harmless error without getting into the jurors' minds to know how much weight and credibility or credence they gave that. So the concern that we have is that the case ought to be decided on the very facts as presented to the jury, whether it's through Ms. Hartman and through the police investigation, and not based solely on, or I shouldn't say solely, but not based as well upon the fact that my client has a 12-year-old conviction.
So how is the government supposed to disprove somebody's theory that he's just at the wrong place at the wrong time?
By relying on the factual evidence that is particular to that case. I think that the government has to make that analysis before they even go to grand jury.
But, of course, they did that here. They show he's not just wandering around the driveway. He's engaged in dressed in weightlifting dress and has the gear. And the weightlifting gear is located in the same place as the drugs.
Yes.
It does suggest he's not just a bystander caught up wrongly.
Yes, that's correct. Then let the jury decide the case based solely on those facts and don't throw in at the end that, oh, by the way, he has a prior conviction for dealing cocaine. If there are no further questions at this point, I'll defer to Mr. Geller and save any response I have. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Geller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Tony Geller, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. The government essentially filed its notice of intent to use 404B evidence several weeks prior to trial, citing the cases that we've cited in our brief that...
I don't even understand what 404B evidence is. Anything properly called 404B evidence is propensity evidence, and it's excluded. How many times do we have to say that 404B is a rule of exclusion rather than admission? The rule of admission is Rule 402.
Correct, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that what the government did in this case is it followed a number of cases. I think there were about five or so.
You take my point. As soon as you call something 404B evidence, then the district court has to keep it out. That's what 404B does.
Correct. I guess what I'm trying to say is we showed it was relevant and therefore admissible pursuant to Rule 402 because we cited the 404B.
Because it was outside
the exclusion. Rule 404B is your position.
Right.
But,
yes.
But my question is this dusty old, 12-year-old conviction seems to me much more likely to create mischief in this case than to allow one to draw any inference as to why this man standing there in his weightlifting, clothing outside this particular house. Kind of like last week he had done something where you could say, his claim that he doesn't know that there are drugs in the house right next to his weights is implausible. 12 years old?
Correct. I mean, as I'm sure you know, Your Honor, that this court has recognized that there are cases as far as 13 years out.
I know. I mean, but it really depends on the circumstances, and I'm not even sure those are right. But this one is out at the edges, right?
I think so, but I think you have to consider, too, part of the reason why it was offered. I mean, there were a number of reasons it was offered. Part of it is this bystander theory that's talked about in Macedo and Chavis and Hearn and all those cases.
I must say I don't understand how a conviction responds to a bystander theory other than through a propensity inference.
Well, in this
case, that's the one thing that Rule 404B says you can't argue.
Well, in this case, though, keep in mind that there were a number of drugs that were in plain view, that were out in the open. There were scales, those things.
This man is going to be convicted with or without the prior conviction. My question to you, and Judge Wood is asking the same question, how, other than by a propensity inference, does an old conviction defeat an argument, I was just a bystander?
Well, in this case, again, the fact that these drugs were in plain view, it shows a familiarity and a knowledge.
Look,
with the
we're asking about the conviction. The fact that the drugs were in plain view is not the conviction.
Right.
Now, is it your argument that the fact of the conviction shows that this man would recognize these things as drugs, whereas somebody who hadn't been convicted wouldn't recognize them as drugs?
Is that the argument? Part of it. Yes, that is part of the argument.
Why is that a sensible inference?
Well, if one is convicted of dealing in cocaine even 12 years ago, one is obviously familiar with cocaine at the time of that conviction, and therefore the inference would be that if he was in contact with it in the basement, especially considering all the other evidence, that would tend to show the fact that he intended to exercise direction and control.
I don't understand how this gets put together. Are you arguing common method of operation so that the facts underlying the prior conviction involved the same kind of presentation or appearance or packaging of drugs as the current one?
No, I'm not arguing the modus operandi.
It's really easy to imagine how somebody 12 years ago is, say, a courier in a drug operation and is driving drugs by car, wouldn't get any information from that offense about how to recognize and distinguish drug operations in someone's basement. So I'm still left with the question, how does the fact of conviction help to negate the defense?
Well, I mean, the defense in this case, I mean, part of it is that the government is following those cases that this court has already talked about, that Judge Wood alluded to, Hearn, Chavis, Macedo, Mallett, and at least a more recent Jones case. Those cases talk about how it can, and there are prior convictions in a couple of those cases, in particular Hearn.
If Hearn stands for what you say Hearn stands for, maybe we need to overrule it.
Well, what Hearn, Chavis, and Jones, all three of them stand for, all three of those cases involved a prior conviction that was admitted for exactly the purpose that the government admitted the conviction in this case.
But I can't get you to articulate a purpose that doesn't involve propensity. The argument that it shows knowledge of how drugs are held in basements doesn't seem to me sensible, because the conviction itself, as opposed to the facts underlying the conviction, doesn't imply knowledge of any particular way of holding or dealing with drugs.
Well, again, I think you have to consider the fact that some of these drugs were in plain view, and it's not simply the knowledge of the particular packaging, it's the knowledge of the appearance of the drugs themselves. And also, it does tend to show that this individual, and this is another thing, in other cases that this court has decided where there have been these sort of joint occupancy situations where one individual, the defendant, is arguing that it is the other person who,
Counsel,
in fact...
wasn't there overwhelming evidence, even without...
I think there was strong evidence in this case, yes. And that's, well, part of my brief certainly is a harmless error analysis if you do get to the point where the 404B was not... the evidence was improperly admitted. There was strong evidence, but the government can never necessarily know what the jury is thinking. And I think that the government is entitled, especially under the five cases that this court has previously decided, to present all the evidence that we have. And if we simply have a strong case, then we have a strong case. One of the things that I don't believe the appellant mentioned. But as in his brief is this old chief argument. I wanted to say a couple words about that. I think that old chief is inapplicable to this situation. Briefly, in the government's brief, there's a preservation of error issue. That theory was never presented to the district court, to Judge Springman in this case. Old chief was never mentioned, and it was never brought up. And essentially what the appellant is asking this court to do with regard to that analysis is to ignore the express old chief opinion, where the Supreme Court stated that their decision was essentially limited to proof of felon status and not to the sorts of things that 404B type of evidence. So, and then even this court has expanded on that and talked about that in a number of cases as well that are in the brief. So the old chief argument simply is not, number one, it wasn't preserved at the trial court, and number two, it just simply does not apply to the situation we have. I have nothing
Although
else.
Old Chief is interesting for one thing, which is that it shows that proof of a prior conviction is very useful to prove felon status, right?
Correct.
That at least is, if that were a relevant fact in the case, then that's how you would prove it.
And one of this court's other decisions that talks about the Old Chief case is Williams. It's in the brief as well. But there's also a 404B aspect to the Williams case where the defendant actually talked about stipulating to intent and those sorts of things. But in the Williams case, this court found that stipulation would be inadequate because the knowledge that would be proven by the 404B evidence would also prove the disputed element of possession. There are no other questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Gevers?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one point, if I may. The court rightly asks about overwhelming evidence and therefore whether or not in that analysis this becomes a harmless error. Conceding for sake of argument that there may be overwhelming evidence, although we may suggest otherwise, we're asking the court to really consider then and ask the question, well, if there was overwhelming evidence, then what's the purpose of allowing this in? And what's its probative value then? And if the answer to that is, well, it has next to no little probative value, then it shouldn't come in. Its probative value is far outweighed by its prejudice. And how do we determine if, in fact, it's truly harmless? Because we can't get into the jurors' heads to know exactly what they were thinking and how much credence they gave to it. So we're asking the court to consider that angle as well. Thank you for your time this morning.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.